This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna Chakrabarty is out today. Just after midnight, 23 years ago today, two men dressed up as Boston police officers bluffed their way into the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, tied up two night guards, and walked out with 13 masterpieces, including one Vermeer, five Degas, and three Rembrandts. The haul was valued at $500 million and remains one of the largest unsolved art heists in American history. Well, just a short while ago, in what can only be called a major and dramatic development in the case, FBI agents in Boston said they've identified the robbers and revealed that the stolen art was once offered up for sale. The FBI hasn't released the names of the thieves, but described them as belonging to an East Coast criminal group. They appealed to the public to help them locate the paintings. Here's Special Agent in Charge of the Boston FBI office, Richard DeLauriers.
It's likely over the years that someone, a friend, neighbor, or relative, has seen the art hanging on a wall, placed above a mantle, or stored in an attic. We want that person to call us. We also want current or previous residents of Philadelphia and Connecticut and elsewhere to know they are eligible for up to a $5 million reward.
That reward has been offered by the museum itself. Joining me to talk more about these latest developments in Boston's most famous art heist is Ulrich Boser. He's the author of The Gardner Heist, the true story of the world's largest unsolved art theft. And welcome to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ulrich, what did we actually learn today? How significant was what you heard from the Boston FBI office?
I think we learned two things. We learned that the FBI has a high degree of confidence in the identity of the thieves. And to some degree, we've known that for a while. My book talks in great detail about the evidence that implicates two individuals. But frankly, I think the more interesting thing that happened today is the FBI also said that they were confident that they believe that the paintings went to the Philadelphia and Connecticut area. Philadelphia and Connecticut suggest a pretty broad area, so they weren't able to track them very closely. But I think that's important because we know that these paintings still exist. People have often speculated that the paintings were destroyed. So I think that we can hear this press conference today and feel confident that these paintings will come back.
Richard DeLauriers, the special agent in charge of the Boston office, he talked about this investigation nearing its final chapter, which sounds like a certain degree of confidence on the part of the FBI.
I think it's important that the FBI expresses this confidence. I think people have expressed some doubt. It's been, after all, 23 years since these paintings were stolen. They're valued at $500 million. That's $500 million. And there's long been this $5 million reward for these paintings. In better economic times, my family could have lived simply off of the interest of that amount of money. So I think it's important that they're expressing that these paintings can be returned. And what's going to be key is the public. People in the Philadelphia area, people in the Connecticut area, someone somewhere knows who robbed the museum. Someone somewhere knows where these paintings are today, and we need people to come forward.
I'm curious why. I'm curious about this. The FBI wouldn't actually name the robbers. They said that they're members of a criminal organization with a base in the mid-Atlantic states and New England, but they wouldn't identify them. They apparently haven't arrested them. Why is that? Does that sound credible to you, or is there a reason that the FBI would only give out so much of the information about what they know about who might have stole these paintings?
That's an interesting point, and I was curious about that, too. I think we can look into the past and say that the FBI has done previous investigations. There is a lot of evidence that looks at an individual named David Turner. He was a longtime gangster in the Boston area. But I think what the FBI is trying to do here is say, look, we are really continuing to press hard on this investigation, and what is ultimately important is that the paintings are returned. People have often thought that if you return these paintings, that you might get arrested, that you might do jail time. And what they're saying is after two decades, what we just want are the paintings.
We just want the paintings. In fact, the U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz said, among other things, that the statute of limitations has run out for the people who actually robbed the museum. She also said there was the possibility of immunity from prosecution for people who might be subject to other charges associated with the theft. So all that seems to be what seems to designed to sort of encourage people, as you say, to come forward and say what they might know about this theft, right?
That's exactly right. Like we saw in the Whitey Bulger case, you know, when cases go dry after such a long period of time, it's the public that is going to be key. They've run down all the obvious leads. They've talked to all the obvious suspects. What's important here is then to really sort of say, who else in the public has that final piece of the puzzle? I don't know if we're right now beginning the final chapter, but I do know that in art theft, hope springs eternal for very good reason. Often it takes years, decades, centuries for artworks to be returned. In another case, we saw the Bill of Rights being stolen out of the Capitol in North Carolina, and it took two centuries for that artwork to be returned. It floated around the art underworld over 200 years until the FBI picked it up in a sting.
Do you suppose, I mean, one of the things that I'm always curious about a case like this, 23 years ago, $500 million worth of fabulously famous and recognizable art. Do you think the thieves have actually managed to make money on this art?
That's a great question, because I think we have this Hollywood notion of art theft. The thieves wear black turtlenecks, that they dress like ninjas, and they sneak in like a Pierce Brosnan or a Cary Grant. But the sad fact is that the people who steal art are, they're out of work criminals. They're aging drug dealers, and they steal art because it is so valuable, and they steal art often because it's quite easy to do relative to other institutions. Museums simply aren't that secure. In the Gardner case, for instance, the museum guard later reported to say that he was smoking marijuana on the job. So, you know, what's important to keep in mind here is not that the Gardner was particularly lax on the job. For that particular time and place, the security for the Gardner Museum was pretty good relative to other museums. It's just that museums today can't afford to often really give the security to these incredibly famous and now incredibly valuable works of art.
Remind us how this heist was carried out in the first place, because, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, one of the guards was said to have been smoking marijuana, and it wasn't a particularly high-tech situation that got these crooks in there, right?
No, it was remarkably low-tech. In the early morning hours of March 18th, two men approached the side entrance of the museum, and they said that they were police officers, and they really did have the full uniform, hats, badges, even those little pins that police officers wear in their lapels. They said that they were investigating a disturbance, and they were buzzed in by this night guard. And once they were in the museum, they really had the run of the whole place. And they stole Vermeer's The Concert. That's one out of just 36 paintings created by that Dutch master. They also stole Rembrandt's The Storm of the Sea of Galilee, which is the only seascape ever created by the Dutch artist.
I'm curious about this as well. I mean, we know anyone who's been in a museum sees the huge efforts that are made to preserve this art in climate-controlled environments. These paintings now have been out of that world, out of that environment for more than two decades. How is there any hope that these paintings would be undamaged? What's your view on that?
I think we can say two things. We know that some of the paintings did suffer some minor damage. Two of the Rembrandts were torn out of their frames. So we know that they were cut, that they suffered some minor damage. The second thing that we know is that the New England area, Connecticut, Philadelphia, is a particularly bad area to store art in your backyard, in your basement. You have these very hot summers, as we all know, and these very long, cold winters, as we also know. And those fluctuations in temperature, those fluctuations in humidity can be very damaging to works of art like this. But the thing that I think that we can we found out again from today's press conference, and that we know generally from art theft, is that thieves steal these works because they're valuable, because they want to try and make money off of them. And so I can only hope that they stored them in a careful place, that they weren't too harsh with the paintings themselves, because ultimately what we want is these paintings to be returned so that my children can see them, so my children's children can see them and really appreciate these beautiful works of art.
Well, you mentioned criminal steel art in the first place because it's valuable, but how, I mean, looking at other art thefts, how difficult is it to actually sell art like this?
That's a great question, because these types of very valuable paintings are impossible to sell on the open market. Any art dealer is going to look at that Vermeer and know immediately that it was stolen. So it's easy to steal. It's very hard to profit from these types of thefts. So what we see happening on occasion is that these thieves will try to use them as a get-out-of-jail-free card, a type of political bargaining chip. Occasionally, we'll see them ransomed back to the museum or to a private owner. The issue for the thieves is that they often think in this Hollywood way about art theft, that there is a Mr. Big or Dr. Evil who lives in the Mediterranean, and late at night, you know, he's wearing a black tuxedo, and he goes down into his basement with a glass of port to admire his stolen Matisse. But that's really a myth. That's a Hollywood myth. We've never found any evidence that there is such an individual who snaps up these types of high-profile stolen artworks.
And finally, I want to ask you about the reward, that $5 million reward. It's being offered by the museum. It's been out there for some time. What do we know about the success of such rewards? Do rewards like that sometimes often lead to the recovery of stolen art?
A lot of people are motivated by money. And we have seen in many, many cases that these types of reward bring people forward. So it's really kudos to the museum to continuing to offer this reward. It's one of the largest rewards ever offered by a private institution. And kudos, too, to the FBI for continuing to run down leads. After all, it's been 2 decades. They could really just put this case on ice. It is that cold. So this reward suggests the commitment of the investigators, and I think it is also going to help bring people forward who know about what may have happened to these works of art.
Well, it's a fascinating story. Whether or not this is the final chapter, we'll just have to wait and see. But Ulrich Boser, thanks so much for talking to us. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
That's Ulrich Boser. He's the author of The Gardner Heist, the true story of the world's largest unsolved art theft. So here's the good news, everybody. Spring is right around the corner. And we say right around the corner, we mean this week. Hey, now the bad news. As you've probably heard, winter weather is on its way back for at least one more dance with us. It looks like the worst of the latest winter storm will be hitting us overnight and into the rush hour tomorrow. So don't put that snowblower and snow shovel away just yet. Joining us now is meteorologist Mark Rosenthal. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So give us the latest on this latest storm. When's it going to hit us, and how serious is it going to be?
Well, I don't really think it's going to start here until very late tonight. You know, the air is so dry, the dew point's running in the single numbers and teens, so it's going to take a lot of hours to really be able to moisten the atmosphere up so snow will fall. It's snowing now through portions of New York State and Pennsylvania, so probably after 10, 11 o'clock tonight, the first few flakes will be seen. When you wake up tomorrow morning for the morning drive, it should be snowing at a pretty good clip with temperatures close to 30. That means some big problems for the morning drive. Now, even though we're not talking about a foot of snow on the ground at that point in time, there could be 1 to 3 inches of snow on the roadways with some slick going. But it is March, and even though it's cloudy, it's cold, and it's snowing, we still have a high-angle sun out there to melt some of the snow. And I still think Boston's going to be fighting rain at some point during the storm, probably by midday tomorrow, if not before.
And where are we likely to see the most snow in the region?
Well, we're going for still 6 inches or more in the city of Boston out to 128. And then when you get to 495 and beyond, I'm still thinking 6 to 12 inches, perhaps a little bit more in some locales. The jackpot could be southern New Hampshire, where there could be over a foot of snow. But behind this, you know, the fascinating thing to me is this is mid to late March. It's not going to melt that fast because there's a lot of cold air in Canada, and that's going to be whipping in here on Wednesday and Thursday with a lot of wind and low temperatures. The normal high for this time of year, 46, 47 in Boston, that's not going to be realized for quite some time.
You know, Mark, I was looking at some photographs taken exactly a year ago, St. Patrick's Day, 1 year ago. I think the temperature was something like 60 degrees out there. We were all in our shirt sleeves. What a difference a year makes.
It's unbelievable. It really is. And this is really a payback for not having a winter. I mean, I've been saying this all along. When you have nothing in November, December, and January, which is an anomaly, the atmosphere says, okay, let's find a way to balance it out. So it's coming all down in the ninth inning.
All right. Balancing out. Thank you very much, meteorologist Mark Rosenthal.
Sure.
Stay with us. Up next, promises of a very short political career and other observations from Massachusetts Interim Senator Mo Cowan. I'm Anthony Brooks. Stay with us. This is Radio Boston.